I'm Sherry Nichols, alcoholic. Very grateful to be here today. My sobriety date is November the 28th, 1983. I had my last drink at 20 after 4 in the morning. And when I came to that day, I didn't know if it was morning or night. I had to wait to see if it got darker or lighter. I guess we've all been there, right? My home group is the Rush Home Group, which meets Monday through Friday at 5:30 at Stairway 2 in Las Vegas. And I'm very proud to say that it's the best home group in Alcoholics Anonymous. In the tradition of Greg Muth, you're all supposed to say, right on. Thank you. Thank you. Good. Because that's how I feel about it. Actually, any group that I'm calling home is the best home group in Alcoholics Anonymous, of course, because I'm there and I participate. And that's how I feel about myself today. It wasn't always that way. You know, this is it's a good thing because I'm only 5'3". AA, have you noticed this is the only place you get up with no music and you get down with all your clothes on? Which is also not the way it used to be for me. I'm Irish and Indian, and I love to sing, and I love to drink, and the more I drank, the more I love to sing, and sometimes you have to get up on places, and of course, I'm also Irish, and I know a lot about myself, and I'd love to argue with fence posts. Some people have said I'd argue with a fence post. But if you pick a subject and pick a side, no matter what side I feel I know anything about, I'll take the opposite side just so I can debate with you. And a lot of times, nudity being one of my favorite subjects, somebody, you know, who was a smart aleck always said, put your money where your mouth is, and off would come the clothes. And hence a couple of times, has anybody in this room been arrested besides me? Oh, good, good. I'm in the right place. I've been known to speak with the blue-haired people, you know, the ones who don't ever look like they drank anything more than mulberry. And so, you know, you have to break the ice by saying, did anybody ever pee outdoors and fall over? So that's the other thing I love to do is pee outdoors. And still, I love to do that. So sometimes I like to do it just because people don't think I do, you know. It's a lot like, you know, I'm 65 years old and I have 7 tattoos. And somebody said, are you going to show people your tattoos? Well, I read an email that said, pretty soon we're going to have a whole bunch of senior citizens running around with tattoos that used to be this big and now they're this big. You know, because as things get older, they stretch. Well, enough said about that, right? Okay. I'm very happy to be here. And I'm so happy. You know, the big book describes me all over the place, and in particular some of my favorites. I'm one of those real pain in the butts. You know, I'm a big book thumper, and I'm a strong traditionalist. You know, and everywhere I go, I check out literature tables to make sure you have nothing non-conference approved on there. In spite of the fact that Hazelden is supporting us 63%, we're not supporting ourselves anymore, thanks to people being tightwads about the basket, which is a whole other issue that I won't go into now. But you can tell already how I feel about it, which is that I'm very opinionated. But you can find me on page 52 of the big book. So anybody who's a thumper like myself knows that page 52 says I was having trouble with personal relationships. You know, the part, it's the 8 bedevilments, I call them. There's 8 sentences there that describe exactly what I was like before I stopped drinking and during different periods of sobriety also. You know, I felt useless and full of self-pity and fear, and I was unhappy and unable to earn a living. And it goes on, you know, with things like that. So usually what I like to do whenever I'm feeling distressed at some point, you know, is I sit down and read that page 52 and think about which one of those sentences applies to my life at the moment. A lot of times it's that I feel useless. It's important for us to feel like we're useful. So page 18 describes what I think is the perfect, well, there's no, I looked for it because I'm one of those really anal intellectual people that thought I was too smart for this program. You know, I came here and was way educated, way beyond my capacity. And I looked for differences. I looked for ways that I didn't fit in. And I bought the book the first day with a bad check, which bounced. Paid membership dues at the club, which also bounced. She didn't tell me until I had like 90 days that my checks had bounced. But I looked for differences so that I wouldn't fit in, because the very first minute I walked into the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, exactly what it says in A Vision for You is what I felt. I saw what's available in this room. I saw the things, just like it says in there, the indefinable something in the eyes of the men. I didn't want to see it in the eyes of the women, of course. It was there, and they were offering me their phone numbers. I didn't want anything to do with the women and the phone numbers. I had a different idea, an old idea, if you will. You know, I was going to have God in my life because I was going to have a man in my life who had God in his life. I was going to get it by osmosis, the way a lot of us. Women come into Alcoholics Anonymous with exactly the same old ideas in place that men do, just in case any of you think it's only the men who prey on the women. And I had, within 60 days, a ring on my finger from an old-timer who had 27 years. And he considered that I was his gift of sobriety, you know, for waiting that long for me, you know. Because I'm Irish and I'm a con, and I can get you to believe anything I want you to believe if you give me enough time and enough motivation. So, that being said, he discovered what I was really like at about 90 days of sobriety, and so he disengaged me, but he let me keep the ring. And I later made another ring out of all the different engagement rings. It was a little pinky ring, and I've lost weight, and it doesn't fit anymore, but it has a whole bunch of diamonds in it from all those engagement rings, and his was one of them that made that ring. But I'm one of those, I like to say it's spontaneous. You know how if you've had your third or fourth drink and you get this really good idea? Well, I got married 4 times based on the same premise. You know, 15, 20 minutes, he asked, I said yes, and I never waited very long. It was either, the quickest time was 20 minutes. I was in Mexico just on the other side of the border, right down here, as a matter of fact. I was on my first weekend pass from the mental hospital. I'd been there since March, you know, and he came to see me, and this was Labor Day, and we went to Mexico, and they said, do you want to? And we looked at each other and said, why not? And so we got married. He had to return me to the mental hospital, though, but I had this paper, and I thought it was going to get me out of the mental hospital. What it got me was quarantined for 30 days till they made sure I wasn't pregnant on their watch. You know, everybody's got the CYA principle going for them, you know. But I always called myself spontaneous. If it seemed like a good idea at the time, I did it. And that included a lot of things. You know, I mean, I would leave wherever I was to go have a drink someplace with whoever happened to want to have a drink. And we'd drive sometimes from L.A. to San Clemente or the El Toro Marine Base and pick up 3 or 4 Marines, you know, who were willing to party. And we'd party, and then I'd have to get back to work on Monday. And so I'd be throwing people out of my car quickly so I could head back to L.A. And it always seemed like a good idea, pitching quarters in the parking lot with the guys from the shipping department after work. For shots of tequila, also seemed like a good idea, except that I was the controller of the company. And the way that I behaved, you know, and I reported to the boss, and don't you think that they had a little disrespect for the things that I wanted them to do, you know, the way I wanted them to run the systems and all that, because they'd seen what I was really like. My boss, very nice guy, he had no clue. Things, I never could control the way I behaved, even though I wanted to behave decently. Something just got a hold of me and I couldn't do it. My temper. Let's take my temper, for example. I'm Irish. I told you that. I'm also half Indian. Now, if you add those two things together and then add 1 ounce of alcohol, you get...
crazy.
Yes. You get, you know, I'm not going to swear from the podium, but you get the idea of what I get. And somebody would say something to me that I didn't like. And then somebody else would get hurt because I'd lose my temper and then I'd go to jail. So alcohol, anger, hurt, and jail, in that order, usually is how that happened. And the more I had to drink, the less able I was to predict how I would behave. Now, the book says that I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I'm like today. And that page 18 that I told you about that I'm so fond of, it says, if I'm armed with information about myself and I'm willing to tell it to you, I'm paraphrasing, and I'm willing to tell it to you in a way that doesn't sound like an axe to grind or holier than thou, or giving you a lecture about something, you know, that it will win your confidence and you will realize that I have an answer to the problem that we share. We have a common problem. I mean, if you're here for the same reason I'm here, usually people don't go to AA meetings on Saturday night unless they're here for a reason. So I didn't get here by accident, and I didn't get here kicking and screaming either. And I'm also, I'm not really good at this, you know, I'm not good at the chronological order of it, so if I start something and forget about where I was in the middle and, you know, you want an answer to that, you can ask me afterwards. But I just sort of I ask God to help me tell the truth, which I never used to do, and whatever comes out, comes out. So I want to tell you that I know every single bad thing about myself. I told someone else the truth, even though I didn't want to tell somebody else the truth. And I want to tell you, you'll get the idea of what I used to be like, but I want to tell you what happened to me, and you'll see what I'm like today from that. I got here because, and this is very important to me, and it's all about the traditions as far as I'm concerned. I got here because I saw a women's television show about women and alcoholism. And I took a drink the Friday after Thanksgiving that year, and I drank nonstop until the Monday following. And that morning, that Monday, was the morning I woke up and cracked open a Bud, lit a cigarette, and looked at my watch, and it was 20 after 4, and I wasn't sure, looking out the window, if it was day or night. And I thought, well, I'll drive home. And I couldn't remember the last time I'd been home. And I had three big dogs, an Irish Setter, a German Shepherd, and an I don't know what, that weighed about 70 pounds. And all three of them had been locked in my house, plenty of food and water, but no way to get outside for several days. I couldn't remember the last time I'd been home. Or when I'd seen my children or talked to my family, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to be at work. I could remember Thanksgiving Day, but that was the last clear recollection that I had. I could remember the police coming. I could remember going to the emergency room. I could remember falling down in the street and bruising my knee. I was wearing shorts and high heels and something that was barely covering my top. And that was about it. And it was November, late November. And I'd been sleeping in my van when I came to. Well, I'd been passed out when I came to tell you the truth. So I drove home. And then I passed out again. Went back and laid down in the back, passed out again. And when I came to, it was daylight. So I knew then it was 20 after 4 in the morning when I woke up. Every single year since then, and it'll be 26 pretty soon, I get up, I set the alarm for 20 after 4, and I get up. And I get on my knees and thank God for one more year of sobriety. I'm so grateful. Now, the funny part is I opened that beer, drank a couple slugs, and then headed for home with my cigarette. If I had known it was going to be my last one, I probably would have finished it. But I didn't know. And I had like 4 or 5 cases of Budweiser in my truck and a whole big black garbage bag full of pot. I had to have all the bases covered, and I firmly believe in better living through chemistry. Firmly. I needed a lot of help in order to live the lifestyle that I was living. I was barely holding it together with those two kids. I was almost $50,000 in debt. I didn't own a piece of property. I had two cars. Neither one was registered or insured. I had no trouble with the first half of the first step, which talks about the unmanageability of life. And my sponsor told me that if I could relate to Bill's story and see the progression of the disease, and see the physical description of the allergy and the doctor's opinion, that the chances were pretty good that I was alcoholic. And I swear to you today, the only thing I knew for sure when I got here was that I was alcoholic. I had the allergy in the worst possible form, and it hadn't always been that way. I used to be able to drink, like the book says, you know, see others drink with impunity. I used to be able to do that. I used to be able to drink, have a good time, go home, get up the next morning, go to work, be responsible, raise my children, go to school. I got good grades. I had 2 degrees. I thought I was God's gift to the business world. I was an accountant. I had a degree in business management. I mean, I really thought I had it together, and people in my industry respected me. What they didn't realize was that I lived my life in compartments. I had work and the people in it in one compartment. I had the people at the bar in another compartment. And I had my family and those people in another compartment. And I never wanted any of those three things to mix. I never wanted to have the people from the bar to my house or bring my kids to picnics and whatnot at the bar. I didn't like taking them to work with me. I didn't really want anybody from work to know anything or party after them. The guys in the shipping department were different. They all spoke Spanish, not English. And so they couldn't rat me out, so to speak. But, you know, it was just, I had my lifestyle in compartments, and there was a reason for that. The bottom line to me being alcoholic is that I drank long enough and hard enough that I went from a cucumber to a pickle. I developed the allergy to alcohol that dooms me to drinking. If I take one drop, the obsession sets in, and I am doomed. And I can never predict it. I mean, those clinical trials out there with all those chemicals and things, they're guaranteed to react the same way every single time on every single person that takes it, no matter what, except alcoholics. You add that stuff, any of it, Tylenol, Contact, Benadryl, you add any of that stuff to an alcoholic, And 2 plus 2 isn't 4 anymore. Now 2 plus 2 equals 12. Because we have a synergistic reaction to things, and our allergy changes exactly how it reacts on us only. We are exactly what the doctor says. We are a class apart. We're a different breed of people. We're bodily and mentally different. The very first meeting I ever came to, I heard that, and I recognized what it had been about me all these years. People used to say to me or say about me what a nice person I was until I'd had too much to drink. She's a great kid until she's had too much to drink. I never knew when too much was too much. I never, ever liked it when they took the drink off the bar. My disposition, if I was laughing and having a wonderful time, my disposition went straight to hell the minute they jerked that drink off the bar. And oftentimes I wound up in handcuffs. And I had this really, really bad temper. I'm such a nice person today, and I'm a grandmother, and I'm 26 years sober, and I don't swear at group level anymore. I don't sleep with anybody I'm not supposed to. I keep my clothes on in public. I'd love to be able to tell you I haven't been arrested since I've been sober, but unfortunately that's not true. I was 4 years sober, and they passed that law about not smoking in public supermarkets, and I was still smoking then, and, you know, some little assistant manager with this kind of a smile on his face. I had the cigarette in my left hand, which is paralyzed, and I never really even noticed it was in my left hand, to tell you the truth, until he came toward me with a smile, and I knew instantly in a little bow tie and the white shirt I wasn't going to like what he had to say. Half an hour later, I'm in handcuffs in the back of the police car. Still can't figure out what it was exactly that happened to me. And what happened is he wanted me to do something I did not want to do, and I told him how I felt about it, and he called the cops because he was afraid. And I mean, I look harmless. I am harmless today. I wasn't harmless then because I could never predict. And you add alcohol to it, and I became this instantly unpredictable person who could go over the edge into rage. I have 3 felony convictions for bad, nasty things. Before they had the 3-strike law, luckily, my record has all been expunged. In fact, the last time I got arrested, I have to tell you this, I was 20 years and 1 month sober, and I got arrested. And they didn't charge me. They arrested me, but they didn't charge me with anything, and I show up in court on my belly button birthday of all unfair things at 8 o'clock in the morning, and they dismissed me. Well, I do taxes. I'm an accountant, and the IRS has now passed this new thing, you know, where you have to go through all this stuff, including fingerprinting, in order to e-file for other people. So I'm filling out the form. I'm getting the fingerprints. I'm sending it off. And they sent me back, congratulations, and da-da-da-da-da. And then the next day, I got a letter that says your application's rejected because they had this arrest in 2003, I think it was, 2003. 2003, December 6, 2003. On my record, and they want me to explain it. Well, I could have explained it, but I really didn't want to explain it. So what I thought was I sponsor a woman who's in the district attorney's office in close to Los Angeles, and I would get her to get the record, and she would write me a letter that would explain it. Well, she couldn't find anything on it. She said, well, why don't you just tell them there is no record of this arrest, and what would you like me to do to clear it, because I really want to be part of your program. So I did that, thinking, yeah, right. I know how anal the IRS is. I'm anal. I fit right into them. I'm so anal. They took her suggestion. They wrote back and said, okay, you know, you're fine. You're cleared, and here's your number. You know, the truth really is what it is. The truth really does set me free, because I have told the truth about myself for nearly 26 years to the best of my ability. Now, I wasn't always that way sober either, I have to tell you that. But to the best of my ability, I've told the truth. And when I came to AA, I didn't know how old I was. Has anybody ever lied about their age? I am the only one. Oh, my God, I'm in the wrong place. I wanted to make myself older so I could work in a bar. And I was a topless bar that I wasn't old enough to even drink in. So I changed my birth date and my zip code. And then I had it laminated so you couldn't tell. And so I instantly was 3 years older. And I liked being 3 years older. Made me more experienced. Of course, if you're a liar, which I was, and you want to convince other people, which I did, I had to adjust everything else in my life to match the new year. So I graduated from high school in a different year. I got married in a different year. The children were born in different years. I mean, it all happened in very different years, except for, you know, then I wanted to be younger because somebody thought I was too old. And I, the girl in the shipping, in the pattern making department was Oriental and wanted to do my horoscope. And I knew already I was in the year of the dog. I didn't like that year. I wanted to be in the year of the cock. So I added a year. So now I'm 3 years older and 1 year younger and then another year older. And I, by the time I got to AA, I had no idea how old I was. So I'm 3 years sober now, and my sponsor said, send away for your birth certificate so you can find out how old you are. And I thought I had joined AA at 40 because I wanted to skip 39 because I didn't want anybody to think I was lying about my age because of the Jack Benny thing, you know, so I skipped it, and I was 42 years in a row. But as it turns out, I got here in 1983, and I was 38. So now I know how old I am, but I have no idea how old I was when any of those things happened because I lied about it all the time. So, you know, I'm really fond of saying that this place is full of liars, tramps, and thieves, you know, and I fit into all those categories. I tried to, and this is really no pun intended, I mean, I don't mean this in the sleaziest way at all, but I tried to fill up the hole inside with anything else until I found out from my sponsor that that's where God belongs. That's where the God of my understanding is supposed to belong. But because I'm alcoholic and I drank enough to make myself into a pickle, I had no idea what I was trying to drink away. And that was the feelings that I had about myself. Now, among all of the other things that I've been, I also had multiple personalities, which was not diagnosed until one day in some therapy session. You know, in the, let's see, it was the 70s, I think, late 70s, early 80s, you know, when Est and Silber Mind Control and Life Spring and all those things were popular, and Claudia Black hadn't written Beyond Recovery yet those days. I got sober before Issues, I thought. Anyway, I'm in this therapy thing, and I open my eyes, and I'm somebody else. And I had no clue because I was still back in the who I thought I was. And the therapist recognized that, and so he immediately sent me off to this multiple personality specialist. And I spent 18 months going to her, integrating and finding out a lot about myself. Part of which I found out was the fact that I had been abandoned by my mother when I was 13 months old. She left me with neighbors to get a loaf of bread and never came back. And she may have been one of us, because the family always said about her, well, she was a full-blooded Indian for one thing, but the family always said about her that she was never really too reliable. She'd disappear for 2 or 3 days at a time with no idea where she'd been, which is why my dad said that he divorced her. Anyway, my dad sent his family out to get me from where I was and bring me back to Minnesota. And when I got there, I immediately caught the epidemic of polio, which was going around, and spent almost 4 years in a hospital. Was in an iron lung for over a year, and when I got out, I had braces holding my neck up and on my legs and around my waist. I mean, I was, I had been paralyzed for a long time, and now all I have left is this left arm, which is just partially paralyzed. But I had a chip on my shoulder, a large chip on my shoulder, and the kids in the neighborhood teased me, and I developed this really nasty bad temper. Hated to be teased. To this day, I hate to see anybody teased. I hate to see the kids teased, the dog teased, dangling anything. You know, I want to shoot the hand off of somebody that's dangling. And that, you know, and I did that a couple of times. One of my ex-husbands, as a matter of fact. That's the other thing that I had, was this really bad temper, and I was raised in a family that used a lot of weapons, and so it just sort of came naturally to me. And when you're angry and you can't think of what to say to the person, you know, then you just reach for a weapon and let that speak for you. And so I did that. So now you know what I was like. And aren't you happy I don't drink anymore? Yeah. Because now at least I've worked out all of those anger things, and I've had 20-something years of continuous therapy in sobriety. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, this damaged person, because I know I was going to make this point earlier and forgot it, got sidetracked. I saw a television show one day about women and alcoholism. And alcohol almost always in the later years got me to the point where I was crying because something would trigger me, and I'd start to cry, and I'd cry, and they had to leave me alone when I was crying because that's when I was in the worst possible mood. Or I'd be angry in a blackout rage and on my way to jail and sometimes not even remember why. But I never liked people picking on somebody else. The underdog I would stand up for. The very first time I got arrested, I was on the steps of City Hall marching for NAACP. Dr. King was speaking, and I was marching. And we were all marching. And of the ones that they arrested, I was the only one who, I was the only woman who was arrested. And it took me longer to get out than the rest of them because I had an arrest report. When you have a really good vocabulary, there's a great way to say a lot of things to people that think they're smart. You know, and all you have to do is say it to some policeman who thinks he's really smart and macho, you know, and they don't like that. And I really didn't care if they liked that. And I'm trying so hard to say all of this without saying anything that I'm not supposed to say from the podium. But, you know, well, there's enough of that. So, but anyway, I had this bad temper and this underdog complex, and I'm going to defend somebody. Now, if you're a woman in a bar and you don't want to talk to this obviously drunk guy who wants to talk to you, you don't even have to look like you're disgusted with him in order for me to come up and be your champion and want to bat away this guy. And he doesn't want to have anything to do with some woman driving him away. So in this case, guns, knives, pool sticks, and chairs come in very handy. And so then you get thrown in jail for trying to defend the honor of some woman who really didn't want her honor defended in the first place. And then there were those women, you know, who'd go into bars and drink. Now, I didn't like men very much, and I also didn't like women at all. Now, that doesn't leave you too many people to drink with. I had contempt for everybody. I never wanted anybody to buy me a drink, so I would buy you a drink. I wouldn't let you buy me a drink unless you'd buy two or three people around me a drink, because I didn't want to owe you anything. So I'd buy you a drink first, and then you'd buy me a drink, and then we'd buy a couple other people a drink, and pretty soon we're getting drunk enough, we're buying the house a drink, and you know, and it goes on like that. And so I was spending a lot of money that I shouldn't have spent. Like Chuck C. said, you know, I spent money I didn't have trying to impress people I didn't like, which is how I wound up, you know, almost $50,000 in debt. I hadn't paid my rent in 3 years, and I kept getting arrested, and the lady who owned my house that I was renting would come and bail me out of jail, and I'd write her bad checks, and she didn't want to keep really good track of it because her husband would say, why are you doing this? And so she didn't tell him, and once I knew that she wasn't telling him, then I knew I could get away with it. And you know, and it goes on and on and on, and that poor woman, I owed her $27,000 of the $48,000 I was in debt, and I never had any intention of paying any of that money back. I want to be honest about that. I'm a con. If God hadn't meant them to be sheared, he would not have made them sheep. And that's how I felt about it. If I could get it away from you, it belonged to me, and I was never going to pay it back. And if you brought it up, I could turn it around to make you wrong for bringing it up or make you feel bad with some other lie because I was really adept at lying. So here I am. It's November 1983. I've driven off husband number three. Husband number one, they had it annulled because I was underage and taking Thorazine because I was in the mental hospital. And husband number two, he called up and said, how are you? And I said, I'm fine and my daughter is fine. And I led him to believe that she was his. And he said, you want to get married? And I said, okay. And that was Friday and we got married on Sunday. 3 years later, I realized she wasn't his, but I wasn't going to tell him that until, of course, I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, these things have a habit of leaking out because I tell one lie and then I have to cover that lie up with another lie. And the one that I really thought was her father, and I was wrong about that too, he one night we're drinking in the bar and he said, is she my daughter? And I said, yeah, because I thought I could get something from him for it, for that piece of information. And I did. Over the next many years, I borrowed like $18,000 from him, which I since paid back after I was sober. But like I say, I was manipulative, dishonest, and a con. And anyway, so she shows up one day in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sitting up here in the front row about a week after I'd taken my fifth step with my sponsor. And she stands there in the meeting, and I'm the secretary of the speaker meeting. And she says, what do you mean he's not my father? And my sponsor's sitting right next to me. Thank you, God. And I thank God I did not have to tell her, oh, by the way, there is some little something I left out of my fifth step. She knew instantly what Becky was talking about. And so she and I and Becky left the meeting, and we went and had a little conference about it. And Becky and I went to several therapy sessions while I tried to explain how could a woman drink enough so that she really wasn't sure who her child's father was. And I don't know if there's any other women in this room who've ever had that problem, but like I say, God tells me whatever it is, you know. And so just in case you've had that problem, of course, I would love to tell you that had a happy ending. My daughter's 39 years old, has tried Alcoholics Anonymous two or three times. We don't do it right, according to her. And When she was 37 was the last time she came here. She said, Mom, you didn't quit till you were 39 or 40. I've got a couple more years to drink. And I never diagnosed anybody. I had a sponsor who had 16 years of sobriety, and one day she said, you know, I don't think I'm alcoholic. What am I going to tell her? You're wrong. Book says you get to diagnose yourself. So even though I'm a grateful, thank you, member of Al-Anon for 23 years, I don't diagnose anybody, including somebody I sponsored, and I held her fifth step in confidence. She was 3 years sober, and one day at breakfast she said, I don't think I'm alcoholic. And I said, you know, the book says, step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try it more than once. Try to drink and stop abruptly. It's worth a bad case of the jitters if you can convince yourself of the true nature of your situation. And I told her that, and she told other people that. And women in Alcoholics Anonymous castigated me for it. That's castigated me for it. You sent her out to drink and die. No, I didn't. I just simply said, here's what the book says. I don't have an opinion about you and your drinking or your alcoholism. I get to decide for myself that I can never take another drink, and that's the only thing I had going for me when I got to AA. The only thing was because this one day after coming to, I went and locked myself in my garage and drank the earthquake supply of water for 3 days and shook it out and smoked cigarettes and called the suicide prevention line, and this guy on the other end of the phone asked me if I had a problem with alcohol, and I was insulted. What do you mean? Well, do you have a problem with alcohol? I said, no. When I want a drink, I do, and when I don't, I don't. And with just that arrogance, you know, that Irish alcoholic arrogance. And I thought, the nerve. Well, a couple of days later, I get into the house, and I'm jittery and trying to figure out how I can wear something. I had no clean clothes. Washer and dryer had long since stopped working. Standing water in all the sinks. Of course, the dogs have been in, you know, for days. I really didn't even want to stay in the house, but I idly turned on the television, and I never watched daytime television. To this day, thank you, I've never seen one soap opera, or one Oprah show, or one Phil show, or any of those mind things. I've never seen any of those things. The reality things, I'm just not a television watcher. I'm an intellectual. Right. And the show is about women and alcoholism. And I remember what the guy on the suicide prevention line asked me, and I thought, you know, I'd check this out. Because I am a woman, and he talked about alcoholism, so I'm listening. And there were several women sitting around in this little thing in the dinosaur kind of a app, that really dates me, I know, but talk show kind of a thing, you know. And each one of those women had something to say that was addressed directly to me. One of them said that she got tired of waking up next to people she didn't know. Where is my car, and where's my car keys, and where are my clothes, and who are you, and who are they, and you know, how did I get here, you know, all that familiar stuff, you know. And then another woman said that when she was a kid, she swore that her kids would not be raised the way she was. And yet she'd come to that place in her life where her children didn't know if she was coming home at night full of broken promises and broken dreams, and she'd get angry at them because she'd forgotten the cotton balls. And just the week before that, my daughter had reminded me with tears that she was supposed to have 300 cotton balls for school that day. And I turned it around and made her wrong. I told you to put it on the refrigerator a week ago. You know, when you've got these things, put them there and tell me it's there and I'll make sure you have your... But you know what? It had been there for 10 days and I didn't see it and I didn't get her cotton balls. And she didn't want to go to school because she didn't have those cotton balls. And I was mad at her and she was crying. And another woman talked about how much she hated women. And you know, all my life, and my therapist, you know, has said, it's because of your mother. Well, of course, my mother left me, and then my dad married some woman who used to put coat hangers on my head, wire coat hangers to my head, and punish me for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or 30 minutes if I was late, and put me in a closet, in a chair with the door closed and the headband on, and then she'd talk to me about how it was going to grow to my head and what the steel would do while it was inside my brain. She filled my life with nightmares. And my father was, you know, I mean, it's so typical nowadays, but until 1984, nobody had any idea how rampant incest is. 4 out of 5 little girls and a lot of little boys, I don't know what the percentage is, are also violated in that manner. And what it did to me was destroy my ability to trust. I was the first person who left myself. I betrayed myself by saying, no, he couldn't possibly be wrong. It's got to be something wrong with me. We all, know, if there are any other incest victims in this room, I want you to know it's possible to be an incest survivor. It takes a long time and a lot of work, but it's worth it. Because today, I'm like a Viking. I'm short, but I'm mighty. And I have information about myself, truth about myself today, that I did not have when I had to drink to change how I felt about myself. And when I changed how I felt about myself, it changed how I felt about you. You were the enemy, not to be trusted, and whatever I could get from you belonged to me because I knew how to get it from you. It's a terrible way to live, and I lived that way 6 or 7 years into sobriety. I was still carrying a gun and a knife and the attitude. People who knew me when I was newly sober, they saw me 5 years later. They'd back up when they saw me come near them because I couldn't be trusted. I shattered a door in the Windsor Club in my home group one night because I didn't like how the cake lady made the cake lady announcement. And I walked out of there saying, if you're here for the same thing I'm here for, you better be here when I get back here because I'm coming back here. And I left and I slammed the door. And the door frame shattered. They now have a steel door frame around there, which my insurance had to pay for. You know, we don't get here as whole people. I mean, my sponsor has this joke that she says she's going to be 40 next year. She's 39 now, and I call her the Empress. She's been everything. She is an Empress, but she also has a great deal of experience for me. And she says, you know, you don't judge another person, Sherry, until you've walked a mile in their shoes. She says, and then you can do it, but then you're a mile away and you have their shoes. She has that way of driving home the lesson, you know, and then making it palatable for me to get the idea, you know, that I meet a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the worst thing I'm allowed to say about that person is, I don't want what you have. And that includes somebody who's sober a lot longer than me. And, you know, or people younger than me, you know, they get to improve. They have a chance. But if you're older than me, you're supposed to be farther along the road than me. And I've complained to her about many people. One in particular we were talking about on the way over here tonight. I've had this resentment about this woman for probably 10, 12 years now. Still. She used to be in the freezer. Now she's in the God box because my sponsor made me get a God box. Go figure. Have a God. Anybody here who doesn't have a God box, do, you know, get one before you're 23 and your sponsor makes you get a God box. Because I didn't know I still had a resentment at this woman until she shows up at 23 and I thought she'd moved out of state, and here she shows up at General Service. And I immediately, everything I felt about her 12 years before that came right to the surface, and I hated her instantly. And she had no clue. She had no clue how I felt about her. How can such a powerful, important person as myself, who makes such an impact on so many people, have no impact on this woman at all, that she has no clue that I have this burning resentment? Well, talk about a dose of humility, right? And the seventh step says the ultimate is I'm supposed to seek and do God's will. So, anyway, that was 3 years ago, though. And she moved away again, so now I don't have to deal with her anymore. But she's resting comfortably in this little cedar God box. It cost me $20, and she's the only person in there. Which is lucky. You know, it's lucky. I mean, I don't have resentments today because now here's the thing. You know, if you're sober a long time, and I know there's a lot of people in here sober a long time. If you're sober a long time, you really don't want to look at the fine-tuning, I call it, the seven-step fine-tuning. Because I don't mind telling you that I drove my girlfriend's car over a cliff with three of us in it, drunk out of my mind, 170 feet. It totaled the car, but all three of us got up and walked away. Did I thank God for it? No. They all thanked me for what a good job I did driving. I was the soberest one and the best driver, actually, and I'm a great driver. It's one of the two or three things that I do really, really well is drive. Here I drove this little convertible car over the cliff in Angeles Crest. Nobody survives that trip, and all three of us got up and walked away from it. And I didn't thank God for 1 minute till after I'd been sober for a while. I had no clue that every single thing that has happened to me in my life, the good and the bad, especially the bad, has been God's will for me. And boy, do I ever stir up the hornet's nest when I say that one. Because some of the things that happened to me when I was a kid are horror stories that those people should have gone to prison for. Still, if they were alive today, they should go to prison, but none of them are alive today. And hopefully I made my peace with them before I die, because I can't afford to have that kind of resentment. I've run into perpetrators sitting in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and those are the people that I feel kindly for, because those are the people I have a common problem with. Those are the people I understand why they needed to drink in order to kill the pain of who they were. That's why I drank. It says we drink for the effect. I drank Crown Royal. Now, I drank Crown Royal because I wanted to impress people I didn't like, but also because I thought it was the best blended whiskey. And I'm Irish, and I didn't want to drink what my cheapskate Irish people did. They all drank CC, and that's what I started on, but I wanted the Crown. I wanted the best. Today, it's $8 a shot. Don't get me started on it's 27 PC and one bottle of Crown Royal and how much that would cost me today. And I drank one-fifth every single time I walked into the bar. They cracked the bottle open, and I made sure I drank every shot before I left and left the bartender a nice tip. Alcoholics Anonymous deserves everything I can give it, all my time, all my money, beyond supporting my family, which I do the best of my ability, anything else I can give it, it deserves. I drove, how far did I drive? 600-700 miles? Because, of course, I had to drive here, drop somebody off, drive to L.A. to see all my friends, drive back here, you know, because I don't get to come to California that often. And the last time I was in San Diego was for the convention. So, but somebody said, wow, that's a long ways to go. I had to go see my home group this morning at 7 o'clock. And I said, you know what, I have been a lot farther for a lot less. I used to drive from L.A. down to San Clemente just to party with a band at Donna Vila because I liked the way they played music. And I would do that on a Tuesday night, you know, when I had to be at work the next morning at 8 o'clock. Alcoholics Anonymous, well, I told you how I got here, right? I saw the show, heard the women, and by the time that 20 minutes after 10 that morning, I knew I was alcoholic because they each said that they were alcoholic. They weren't members of AA, or at least they didn't say they were members of AA. But the things they talked about and the fact that they were alcoholic, I figured I identified with everything. I must be alcoholic. That's the thing that got me here, was that identification. Now, because I did a lot of other Better Living Through Chemistry, I identified it in a different way when I came to AA for the first 18 months. And I got set straight by that. This one guy, about 6'12", picked me up one day and set me outside, and he said, come back when you've had enough to drink and you're a pure alcoholic. Mm-hmm. Ooh. That one kind of did me in for a while. But what I did then was spend the next 5 years with Dr. Paul, researching pharmaceutically and medically and all this other stuff and all the information that was printed or written about the difference between alcoholism and the allergy and the addiction. And I learned where I fit, and I know now where I fit. And there were years when I would tell you what my opinion was about any subject, including that one. Today, I'm so much more mellow now. I have the opinion and I get to share it with Diana's nodding. She's known me for 24 years. And thank you, by the way, Diana, for arranging this with Randy, wherever you are. I never did get to meet you, but wherever you are, thank you, too, for meshing my schedule with Diana's, which is like trying to get an audience with some dignitary. And you wouldn't, we're not that important, you know. We're just the people who say, yes, I'll do it in AA are the people in service. And those people, out of those people, it's only 10% of the people in AA. But 100% of the people in service get to stay sober. 100%. I put as much energy into Alcoholics Anonymous as I did into figuring out how I was going to afford to get my next drink or my next, you know, fill in the blank, because I did everything else. At one point, not too long ago, I weighed 282 pounds. I wore a 3X. I gambled thousands and thousands of dollars because, of course, the more drunk I got, if somebody had a deck of cards, I fancy myself this terrific card player, and you know, my judgment kind of goes out the door, and I take foolish chances. And I think it's all the same disease. I think the ism, the I, self, and me, covers all of the facets. I tried to fill it up with sex, with booze, with dancing. I love to dance. With shopping, with gambling, with chocolate. What's that? Oh, okay. I tried to fill it up with everything. And so I call it different faces of the enemy. And it's like trying to put 5 pounds of flour in a 3-pound sack. It's going to leak out somewhere. There's just no way you can get all that into the same container And even sometimes you take it out of that container and it expands out here or multiplies out here, and you try to get it back in, it won't go. It's just that I love Will Rogers. Even if I'm on the right track, I'm going to get run over if I don't keep moving. Get run over by the train, which is coming up right behind me. I have to keep moving. I have to keep growing. I have to keep addressing all those different things. And so whenever I run into something I can't control, like husband number four, God's will for me, I met playing pinochle. Love to play pinochle. In Alcoholics Anonymous, God's will. God's will, you know, and he kissed me on a Sunday night. We got married on Friday. That was number four. He didn't change, and I was going to change him. And I hadn't read Women Who Love Too Much at that point, you know, and I knew he would change because he loved me so much. But the fact of the matter was, I can't change anybody or anything but myself. And he drank again, of course, and he drove me, or his drinking drove me to Al-Anon. Thank you, God, for driving me to Al-Anon, because I now know all the women that I sponsor, and I limit the number of women very carefully now because I have a life that's important to me. And I only want to impart what I have to people who really want it. And it's not that I'm going to judge them. But on the other hand, if you want what I have, you'll do what I did. I went to way more meetings. I jumped into service. I was Alcoholics Anonymous' number one fan. And I still am today. I have as much passion for it today as I did the very first day I walked in here and felt the welcome and realized the hope that my sponsor gave me. Now, I have 2 minutes? 1 minute? I have enough time to tell you what I think, besides the gift of sobriety that I got that morning, the next most important thing is sponsorship. I firmly believe in sponsorship, and I have been thoroughly sponsored from the minute, you know, whether I liked it or not. I was sponsored by a woman who loved me in spite of what Alcoholics Anonymous dragged in here, in spite of the truth that I learned about myself in all the different inventories that I took, in all the hundreds of thousands of hours of therapy that I've had. What I learned about myself has become valuable experience to pass on to other people. But she loved me and became a bridge for me from where I was in that loneliness to what's possible in Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the woman who drank after 16 years and said, I'm not alcoholic. I loved her so much. All I could say to her was, you know what the book says, Rita? If you are alcoholic, you get to decide yourself. I'm here. My job is to be here to give you my message. But after that day when she told me that she drank, I said to my new sponsor, you tell me something that's going to make me feel better. Because the bottom line, it's always, I'm afraid, like the six steps says, I'm going to lose something I've got or I'm not going to get something I want. If it didn't work for her after 16 years, maybe it wouldn't work for me, and I was 12 then. She said, Sherry, it's not the messenger, it's the message. I said, if you do what we do, you never have to take another drink. Thanks for listening.